KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Benicia.
Sunset District.
I live in Lakeside.
The Western Addition.
Diamond Heights.
Emeryville, California.
Westwood Park.
Coming up, why family members are showing up to pack Santa Clara courtrooms.
Where once upon a time, no one would show up to court for their loved ones. It was just people detained and that was it.
Then, should we really be worrying about robots taking over our Bay Area jobs?
The Bay Area overall is going to be fine. I think the question is, who in the Bay Area is going to be the most fine?
And how sometimes what we think will be the wave of the future isn't.
Some enterprising engineer is in a room full of venture capitalists right now trying to convince them that giant airships are the solution to some pressing world problem.
Thinking about tomorrow, Cross Currents is coming up. When judges weigh whether to send defendants to jail, they consider their criminal history and flight risk. But they also consider whether the person has ties to the community. These decisions can have serious consequences for the people facing jail time and the families who love and rely on them. That's why a San Jose-based group called Silicon Valley Debug is on a mission to help these families fight back against punitive sentences. The group empowers families to show up for hearings and presents judges with scrapbooks of their loved ones' lives, called social biographies. This strategy is called participatory defense, and the goal is to shorten sentences and bring more incarcerated people home. Yolanda Ledesma is an organizer with Silicon Valley Debug. She sat down with KALW's justice reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to talk about her work.
So what does participatory defense look like?
Well, we do have our participatory defense meetings where families gather around the red table you sat at. We start an introduction letting them know that this is a community-based organization. We're not lawyers. We cannot give any type of legal advice. We're here to support the families. The families lead our work. We're just here to support them and guide them through the criminal justice system. They tell us, you know, where their case is at. And then together as a collective, we all come up with like the next steps their loved ones can do, whether that's building a social biography packet to impact like a bail hearing, to impact sentencing. You know, we empower the families. Like, you don't have to just sit here and have the attorneys, whether it's public defender or private attorney, do just the work. Like, you can do hands-on work yourself and make an impact.
How has participatory defense changed the culture in the courtroom?
The courtroom, you know, judges specifically know that families and communities are showing up to their loved ones' cases and just watching how it plays out, what the ruling is, you know, what they're setting bail at. I feel like because they know the communities gain more involved, where once upon a time, no one would show up to court for their loved ones. It was just people detained and that was it. You go to courtroom now here in Santa Clara County, it's pretty packed.
Who are the people who come to these participatory defense meetings?
If it's not the individual with a criminal case themselves, then it's their families. And a lot of the times it's by word of mouth or it's meeting the families at the courthouse.
And what stage in the justice system are they usually coming from?
From a wide range, you know, from, like you said, from arrest, you know, my loved one was just arrested. What do I do? What's going to happen? He's supposed to be arraigned on this date. What does that mean? We get people that come in during sentencing. We have people come in that's done 19, 26 years. I heard this law that just got passed. I don't know if it pertains to my loved one. Can you help us?
Could you tell me about the social biographies? What are they and why are they an important part of the work that gets done here?
Yeah, so the social biography packets that we help families create, it's tailored to that individual. It's tailored to the offense. You know, in the courts, on all they're seen as is in black and white, what the report says, what the discovery says, but these packets help humanize these people. There's family pictures. We have support letters, you know, from family, from community, from their employers, all their like certificates, what they're doing, the activities they're engaged in the community. It tells a whole nother story of this person rather than just reading everything native that's in black and white. And we, you know, they just bring it here and we help them put the packets together. So we're just kind of a guidance to them on, okay, let's look for this, let's look for that. What have they been doing? What kind of activities are they engaged with? You know, their children, the housing, you know, what is the community missing by this person being inside?
And have you seen those social biography packets make a difference in the courtroom?
Most definitely. We've seen people facing a life sentence get their sentence lowered to a year. We've seen people with no bail come home on non-monetary bail and ankle monitor. So it makes a huge difference, a huge impact.
Can you tell me about an example where the social biography packet really made a difference in a case?
Yes, there was actually a recent case. I was helping support a sister with her brother incarcerated and here in county, and he was facing a life sentence. But as she continued to come to our meetings, the brother had taken a plea deal, but even with the plea deal, it was 3 years prison time. So with us meeting with the attorney, suggested we build the social biography packet before sentencing, because this is how the judge is going to rule. And with the effort she put in and gathering all the information, the judge ruled him time served. So he gets to come home.
What's it been like for you when, say, families that you've worked with here have gone through putting together these packets and the outcome isn't like what they hope for?
I try to stay positive and uplifting, because that's not the end. It's not the end, you know. I know firsthand there's different avenues, and you, as hard as it is, you just have to keep going. You can't give up. And if people didn't speak up, if families did not speak up, then these laws wouldn't change. These laws that are helping our loved ones come home sooner than what they're sentenced to are because of the family speaking up.
That was Yolanda Ledesma with Silicon Valley Debug. She was talking to KALW's justice reporter, Holly J. McDeed. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. The idea of robots taking over our jobs has been part of our popular culture for decades.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cat. Where can I take you tonight?
Drive! Drive!
Would you please repeat the destination?
Oh, anywhere, just go! Go!
Please state a street and number.
And it's generally true. As we advance, machines increasingly do the work that people used to do. But at what rate is that happening today in the Bay Area? And are we at risk for losing jobs en masse, in the millions, for example, because of artificial intelligence? Well, San Jose Mercury News reporter Leonardo Castañeda says maybe not. He investigated that question in his latest article. It's called Why Robots Won't Kill the Bay Area's Job Growth. He joined me in studio to explain. Your article, Why Robots Won't Kill the Bay Area's Job Growth. It feels like you're answering a question or an anxiety with that headline. Just tell me about why that headline. What did you want to do with it?
Absolutely. I think when we think about automation and robot workers, we immediately think like mass layoffs. You know, they're coming for our jobs and we're all going to be out of it because, you know, who can compete with a robot?
Mm-hmm.
So what, you know, we wanted to address that and say there's, you know, that is really not the concern that a lot of researchers are most worried about. They're worried about another concern that I think is just as serious as mass unemployment, which is income inequality, which is this idea of the people who own those robots are going to be making a lot more money than they are now, potentially.
And that is the danger that people
exactly.
should be.
That is the danger yeah. because, you know, we know that there's a lot of societal issues that come with income inequality. There's a lot of issues of, you know, discontent, people feeling like they don't have, you know, ways to afford their home or they don't have the wages that they need to live, you know, happy, comfortable life, while there's some who are, you know, controlling more and more of the income and mm-hmm. of the money.
Mm-hmm. So you talk about a study from the McKinsey Global Institute. Tell us about that.
A lot of the times studies that look at automation just say, well, you know, food prep. We can automate food prep, so all the food prep jobs are going to be gone. What this really did is say, well, you know, they're going to be somewhat gone. You're still going to need some people because only certain tasks can be automated.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens to, you know, say you had 10 chefs and now you only need 5 because robots are helping out. Well, what happens to those 5 people? Do they just become unemployed? Do they become the person that, you know, manages the robot and the person who is making sure the robot learns new dishes as you, you know, update your menu? And what, you know, what are the potential paths? Because I think right now we're at a point where automation can really go a bunch of different ways. I think the study finds, you know, there's one way where those chefs become, you know, because they have all this free time now, they can invent new dishes that they never would have had time to come up with. And some of them are going to become engineers because they're going to be so excited about this cooking robot that they're going to build their own robots. And I think that's one future where, you know, that the wealth and the benefits of those robots are kind of shared across the worker spectrum, the income spectrum. There's also a different future that that is, you know, the companies that own the robot are making the wages of those 5 cooks, those 5 chefs, and, you know, those people find another less paying job as, you know, the person who oils up the robot and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So what's really interesting is that this really broke down where are the industries that we're going to see is and what could happen to those folks.
Okay, so we live in an area where tech is big. So how is this going to impact Bay Area industry?
Whichever path automation takes, the Bay Area overall is going to be fine. I think the question is, who in the Bay Area is going to be the most fine?
And the answer is?
I think that's to be determined. I think there is a path where, you know, the tech folks and the people building the automation are the only ones who benefit. I think there's also a path that some of these researchers see where, you know, that wealth is more evenly spread.
So if we talk about demographics, why are Hispanics and African Americans at risk of losing jobs because of artificial intelligence?
The reason is pretty straightforward. Hispanics, African Americans historically haven't had the same access to education than white folks have and, you know, and other folks. So when we talk about automation, it's primarily going to affect those lower skill jobs like food prep, that don't necessarily require a bachelor's degree that for a long time could be, you know, well-paying middle-class jobs and you could raise a family as a chef. Those jobs are the most at risk. And because, you know, African-Americans and Hispanics are more concentrated in those industries, they're the ones who right now are facing the highest risks of, you know, losing their jobs or at least having their jobs, you know, significantly cut back.
And so is there an education part to this on behalf of companies? What are they doing?
Companies, I think, are definitely a big part of this. Automation Anywhere, who I talked to, they have what they call their university, where their people can go and learn how to be the people who are creating the programs that are automating those tasks. Because at the end of the day, I mean, if you're, you know, spending 8 hours a day filing paperwork, it would probably be a lot more fun and more interesting to be the person who's solving these really complex problems about, okay, how do I automate this paperwork and how do I make this more efficient? So part of that is those companies working to make those employees be the people who are solving these issues mm-hmm. and who are thinking critically about their jobs.
So that takes training, and training takes money.
Exactly.
What about that? What are you What have you seen in terms of the plan? Like, these are ideas, but how will this happen?
I think that's a big part of it. And that is the question right now. I think they are ideas. You know, Automation Anywhere has a university, but it's also up to the companies who are implementing this to offer that training to their employees. And I don't think there's anyone out there who's really built a model for how you train workers. You know, we've seen similar situations with, like, trade, with where certain jobs that were really popular here, like textile manufacturing, move away to other countries. What happens to those workers? And I don't think we've had the best track record of retraining those folks to take on new, good-paying jobs. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's not something we've really addressed or solved completely yet.
What does it look like we will see sooner rather than later? You have the image that you have as a part of this article is a coffee machine, a robot barista at Cafe X in San Francisco.
That's right.
So did you get some coffee from that guy?
I have gotten some coffee from them. It's pretty good. It's a solid cup of coffee.
Yeah, but what about the experience?
That's interesting. And, you know, when I've talked to them in the past for previous stories, they're very aware of that because they actually have someone who's out there and talks you through how to use the iPad because they know that you don't want a purely, you know, kind of anonymous experience. You want to chat with someone while you're waiting for your coffee. And the robot will actually do a little dance when it finishes your coffee.
It does a dance.
Because, you know, no one wants to just interact purely with a machine. And I think you actually really hit it on the nail because it's not that we're going to see, you know, baristas everywhere disappear. I don't think we're going to see the kind of like mass industry disappearance that we expected. I think what we are going to see is a lot of these automations will be so small that, you know, the industry that will be most automated will be all of them. I think, you know, it's going to be hard to find a job. I mean, and think about it today, you know.
Because you said automation could eliminate 907,000 Bay Area jobs by 2030.
Right.
So that's scary.
That is scary. But think about it this way. You know, most places don't have a mailroom anymore. You know, they still get mail, but, you know, maybe it's the person who's also the custodian or the person who is also, you know, the receptionist, they also handle that because the volume of mail has come down because at the end of the day, email is just automating mm-hmm. a lot of that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it's that we don't really notice it until it's gone. So I think there's going to be a lot of kind of small, you know, death by a thousand cuts, if you will. It doesn't necessarily have to be a death. It can be, you know, that's freeing up those folks to do more interesting stuff. But at the end of the day, it's kind of throughout the economy. It's every little job can be automated a little bit.
That was reporter Leonardo Castañeda of the San Jose Mercury News. His article is called Why Robots Won't Kill the Bay Area's Job Growth. We've got a link to it at kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. So as we anticipate the automation of many of the jobs that humans do today, one thing to remember is that sometimes the future we expect to happen doesn't. Like in this episode of the podcast 99% Invisible, here's host Roman Mars.
They are hulking, but graceful. Human-made whales that float in the air. For over 100 years, lighter-than-air aircraft have fascinated us, and they have this recurring, starring role in our dreams of an alternate reality, of a future that might have been, where cargo and passengers traverse the globe in a civilized fashion and dock elegantly on the mooring towers on top of Art Deco skyscrapers. For around 100 years, lighter-than-air aircraft were seriously proposed as the perfect design solution for all kinds of problems.
In the 90s, there was a company called SkyStation. They raised some $4.2 billion, or at least solicited it, to put 250 antenna-equipped airships to deliver internet service.
This is Bill Hammack. He's the engineer guy on YouTube and an airship enthusiast.
In the 20s and 30s, they were to fulfill imperial ambitions. Both Germany and the British were looking for that. And the Americans, too. They had imperial ambitions in the Philippines.
It was those imperial rigid airships, heavily developed in the 20s and 30s, that came the closest to actually changing the world. The most promising, most opulent rigid airship of its time, and I'm talking about the 1920s here, was Britain's R101. The R there stands for rigid. When it comes to the dream of airships dominating the skies, the catastrophic and very public Hindenburg disaster may have been the final nail in the coffin, but it was the crash of R101 that built the coffin. R101 was supposed to connect the global British Empire. It was designed to fly from London to Karachi in 5 days. That's 10 days faster than by sea. Taking a plane that distance took 16 days because planes had to stop so often to refuel. Airships could also carry 30 to 40 times the cargo of airplanes. So Great Britain built R101 and R100, which was its sister ship that was supposed to go to Canada and back, as the first two rigid ships in a fleet that would give the crown dominance over the skies to match its centuries-long dominance of the seas. An airship is conceptually quite simple, but it's still an engineering marvel. It's a gargantuan, cigar-shaped math equation, balancing lift on one side of the equation and weight on the other. Minimizing the weight of the airship was always a challenge.
There's that rigid metal framework, and that is one of the most difficult parts because that has to be lightweight yet strong.
On the other side of the equation is lift. You get lift from pumping in gas that's lighter than air. In the case of R101, the gas they used was hydrogen.
In a ship like R101, if you filled it with helium, you would not have enough lift to lift the ship.
The flammability of hydrogen was indeed a concern in airships, but flight engineers and crew were habituated to its dangers, much like we're habituated to the dangers of combustion engines today.
One engineer pointed out, you don't light a match and look in your gas tank in your car when you're driving around with something highly flammable all of the time right now. You get the proper engineering solutions and controls to do it.
The gas bags that contain the hydrogen are their own engineering marvel.
You have a problem in that hydrogen wants to permeate. So you need something that's very strong, that is impermeable to hydrogen, or largely impermeable, and that is lightweight. And so they tried things like rubber, gelatin, glycerin, something called viscose, which is a synthetic fabric. It's coated with latex. But they all failed one way or another. So they used, and this stuns me to this day, the intestines of an oxen. And specifically, the oxen intestine, it's lined with a very fine membrane. It's called the cecum, and it's very thin and flexible, and hydrogen seeps only slowly through it.
Ox intestines are nearly the perfect material, except for the size.
The cecum of an ox is about 30 inches by 6 inches, so a little over a square foot. And yet one of those gas bags, if you laid it out, is 30,000 square feet. There's over 1.5 million oxen intestines that were needed to create the 15 gas bags for R101. And it was fairly grisly work. They delivered from slaughterhouses in Argentina, at least some of the animals, barrels of these guts, and then they would scrape them and go through this long process to prepare them and eventually to glue them together.
R101 had a few test flights in and around its hangar outside London to great fanfare. In fact, Bill Hammack surmises that the focus on PR and fanfare, rather than more rigorous and deliberative testing, led to the tragedy that was about to come on the ship's first attempted flight to India in 1930.
It had left on October 4th, about 6:30 at night, about 54 people on board, traveled across England, it traveled across the Channel into France, and there were these bruising winds. It was just winds so fierce that ground speed was only 30 miles per hour or so. And then a few minutes past 2, it was about 40 miles or 64 kilometers north of Paris, and it kind of chopped through the turbulent air, flying at about 1,200 feet, but moving up and down a couple of hundred feet. And the top cover ripped open. The rain pelted the gas bags. There was some decrease in lift, maybe dropped to 500 feet or so. And the control car, and no one knows why today, signaled for the engine power to be cut off. And of course, it lost all dynamic lift at that point. And it drove nose first to the ground. It slid into a grove of hazel and oak trees, and it burst into flame. At that point, just everything became charred. Only 6 people survived it. The ground was littered with these, you know, very sad everyday things. I mean, suitcases, fur-lined boots, shard shaving brushes, tin of cigarettes. I think there was a ticking watch still there. And then it was very quiet, and all you could hear was the hiss of the rain as it hit the hot metal and it evaporated.
The wreckage had barely cooled when the British government halted their airship program for good.
It was almost immediate. R-100 had flown to Montreal and back, and it was in a shed, and it never flew again. They eventually steamrolled R-100, sold some of the parts for scrap, sold some up to people who wanted souvenirs.
At this point, the airplane has had a century's worth of development in efficiency, speed, and safety, so that the need for the airship has been largely eliminated. But it passed its precedent. Some enterprising engineer is in a room full of venture capitalists right now, trying to convince them that giant airships are the solution to some pressing world problem. In the meantime, the airship will continue on in science fiction stories as this quick and easy visual cue that we're in a world that's like ours, but somehow more wondrous.
That story was produced by 99% Invisible, edited for radio by Vika Aronson. You can hear more episodes, subscribe to 99% Invisible on your favorite podcast player, and make sure you're already subscribed to the Cross Currents podcast too. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Audrey Dilling, Ariella Markowitz, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega-Welch, True Gwynn, and Alice Wolfley. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.